This joint hearing of the Senate Finance and House Ways and Means Committee will come to order on March 1st. And we have only one order of business, which is to have a presentation from Minnesota Management and Budget on the February budget forecast. And for members of the committee that are at the committee table, reminder that when you speak, you have to turn on your microphone. And if you are viewing it on your own computers, please silence it, because otherwise we get feedback. And we have a number of members who are participating virtually. And with that, I don't have anything else, so Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Marty, and just welcome everybody. I think the weather, we were worried we were going to be able to fit our robust House members in here, but I think the weather took care of that, and a few folks decided Zoom was the better option. But I imagine a few folks may filter in late, so thank you for that. And I think what we plan to do is to work our way through the presentation and hold questions until the end. So if you're on Zoom, you'll raise your hand, and if you're in person, we'll do the normal notification, and we'll bounce between House and Senate members for questions, but we will ask that we just hold those until the end. So I think with that, we're ready to get rolling. Is that correct? So welcome to the committee. Glad you made it in person, even with the roads the way they are. So thank you for being here and for presenting and doing this joint hearing. We're glad we can all be together for this information. So with that, Commissioner Showalter, welcome, and please introduce yourself and begin with the presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. With me is Anna Menge, our State Budget Director, and coming in virtually is Laura Colombakita. So we're going to use all of our strategies here. I just appreciate everyone who made it here, and also the flexibility, because I just was sprinting in the door just a couple minutes ago, so quite the day to be here. So thank you. This is we're going to recap what we presented on Monday morning, which is the February forecast. That gives us a sense of where the state's at financially, gives us a lot of detail underneath it about the labor markets, the national and global economy, and ultimately how that affects Minnesota. So, they're the best financial projections we can put together, but obviously over at the Centennial Office Building, we can't see the future. But we will try to explain our assumptions, explain how we got here, and ultimately, help you understand, how this all comes together. A lot of people participated in this. Anna and myself and Laura are privileged to present it, but, the truth is there are analysts and economists who work together to get this, and it's a team effort, and I just got to thank everyone for that work. The bottom line is amazingly close to where we were last forecast. But even though the top line number doesn't change very much, there are a lot of stories underneath it. That includes changes in revenues, changes in spending, changes in statute, change in underlying context, and we'll try to get through those as we do our briefing. In December, I think I mentioned it when I briefed the committees, is that, we were starting to see the forecasts be a little less extreme. And that seems to be borne out with this forecast, that while there's changes inside this forecast, the variability and the unpredictability and the kind of risk that you're looking at seems to be a little less than we had before. If you remember last February when we presented the forecast, it was just days after uncertain conflict started in Ukraine. So, the level of magnitude of things that were happening at that point in time do not match what's happening right now. And so, as a result, I think some of the economic and global considerations that are in this forecast look less variable.
I'm sorry, Commissioner, to interrupt. We're having sound issues on the Zoom, so if we could just pause for a minute while we get that figured out. Thank you.
Okay, if it's not working, Commissioner, continue, please.
Okay. Hey, George, can you just mute the volume on that? Because I'm hearing it going through. So, should I start at the top? Or just keep on going? I could. All right. Let's go to the next slide. Thank you, George.
This slide gives you the key takeaways for the forecast. As I mentioned before, and for those who weren't able to hear, you know, this forecast has a lot of things in it. Although the top line number doesn't change very much, there's a lot of sub-stories, and we'll get into that in this briefing. The variability of the forecast is also not as significant as we've looked at over the last several years. That said, you know, these are some of the key things that the budget forecast still shows us at $17.5 billion. That being the total amount available for the upcoming biennium. This is really based upon a number of different factors, including slightly higher revenues. Those of you who look at the monthly revenue collections that we put out, you know, you see that on a monthly basis, you know, we've been running ahead of expectations, not tremendously, but we've been running ahead, and that really adds to our starting point going into this biennium. The big side piece on the spending side is the statutory inclusion of inflation, as these committee members know very, very well. You know, that's a key element and foundation of the forecast principles. And as a result, when that's folded in, that increases the expenditures that show up in the forecast. The revenue picture is continuing strong throughout the full tenure of the forecast. And one of the things we're always worried about is feedback and sustainability. We got sustainability, but we're working on the feedback. The revenue picture. I feel like Oz. All right. Still sounds. I just have to use fewer words. We'll keep going. Sustainability is good. The revenue outlook through the 4 years going forward remains solid, and Dr. Kalambakidis will walk through that a little bit for you. And that's all really based upon a slightly improved U.S. economic outlook. So let's go to the next slide. Cool. And that gives you a sort of a thumbnail sketch of what's in this forecast. You'll see on the left side, no change really from the starting place of where we were last time, where a lot of the money, a lot of this $17.5 billion surplus is really from prior years. Not just last year, it's the year before that and the year before that. And so those dollars roll forward and get us to $11.6 billion carry forward. That was added to around a $6 billion revenues exceeding spending. And that gets us to the $17.5 billion starting point that we talked about in November. You know, that's sort of the common language. I just want to reiterate, the carry forward isn't money that's coming in 24 and 25. It's actually money that was already on hand as you started that budget biennium. That dark section on the top, the structural balance, is really just a comparison of revenues and expenditures in that biennium. And so those two together gave us a starting point in November. The couple of really significant changes that you see on the slide, starting from the left going to the right, show an improvement in the carry forward. I talked about monthly revenue collections being better than expected. We're estimating almost $900 million in improved collections before we get to the 24 and 25 biennium, and that starts us at a slightly better place. Improvement in the revenue forecast also continues on slightly through the 24 and 25 biennium, adding a roughly $600 million to that. And then those are net out because as we look at the expenditure side, while there's increases and decreases to health and human services and education and the things you'd expect, there's also inclusion of statutory inflation, and that is a significant part of that $1.5 billion. Pull them all together, you get the right-hand sort of picture of the February forecast. We have a little bit more reliance on carry forward from previous biennia, a little bit smaller structural balance, but the top-line number is almost exactly the same. On the next slide, you'll see those same comments in numbers. Beginning balance of about $15.2 billion on the upper left-hand side, being at the November forecast. And you'll see the changes in revenues and in spending and rolling through to the $17.5 billion. Those changes from that starting point to the February forecast are on the right-hand side. You'll see that the beginning balance is improved by $865 million, driven by those increased collections in the current biennium that I talked about before. Additional revenue growth in the biennium shows up as that $599 million. And changes on the spending side include $113 million of the normal kind of education, human services, and other kinds of changes, along with the estimated inflation, which we'll talk about a lot. The reserve changes are very small. There's no changes in the cash flow or the budget reserve. There's only a change in the stadium reserve. And that's tied because that's a dedicated reserve, and it's tied to the charitable gaming revenues that come in. And those are slightly down from previous estimates. So those reduced revenues also lead to a reduced reserve. That ultimately all adds up to a $66 million change in the forecast. Pretty minor in the grand scheme of things when you have about a $60 billion forecast. That said, there's a lot of information beneath that, so with that elongated intro, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Kalambakidis, and we're going to go through the economy, some of the macroeconomic assumptions that are built into this forecast, and how that translates into the state revenues.
Dr. Kalambakidis, please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Chair, members. I'm going to go through the U.S. economic outlook. I'll talk about Minnesota's labor market, and then I'll give you details of the revenue forecast. So since we last prepared a forecast in November, a lot of U.S. economic data have come in more positive than what IHS expected in November. Specifically, U.S. employment and real GDP have grown faster than IHS forecast. IHS is the state's macroeconomic forecasting consulting firm. And CPI inflation has been lower than forecast. Financial conditions have eased. We've got higher stock prices, lower bond yields, a stronger U.S. dollar. So consequently, IHS raised their forecast for economic growth in 2023. So in this chart, as usual, we're showing the height of the bars shows annual growth in real U.S. GDP. The light bars show the November forecast, and the dark bars show the history and the current forecast. So IHS now expects real GDP to grow 0.7% this year. That's 0.9 percentage points higher than what they had in the November forecast. They had a decline in GDP of 0.2% in the November forecast. They've raised their forecasts for real GDP growth in both 24 and 25. To 1.6 and 2.0% respectively. And then beyond 25, the growth rates have been lowered slightly. But if you put it all together, IHS expects real GDP growth to average 1.8% annually for 24 through 27, and that's just above the 1.7% average annual rate in the November forecast. So not a huge change in that economic outlook. As they did in November, remember we talked in November about how IHS had just introduced a recession into their outlook. They continue to expect a mild investment-driven recession. The investment-driven means that it's not driven by consumer spending, which sometimes is the reason a recession happens, but it's driven by changes in business investment, specifically residential investment. But in this outlook, that recession, so recession's still there, but it's shorter, it starts later, it has a smaller decline in real GDP and a lower peak unemployment rate than we had in November. In November, the baseline forecast included three consecutive quarters of GDP decline starting in the fourth quarter of 22. Well, we now know we have an advanced estimate from BEA that says that real GDP grew by 2.7% in the fourth quarter of 22. So IHS has pushed this recession into just this year and shortened it by a quarter. So it's just two consecutive quarters of contraction in this quarter that we're in and next quarter. They expect declining demand to ease the tight labor market, pushing up the U.S. unemployment rate to a peak of 4.6% in 24. In the November forecast, the unemployment rate was forecast to reach 5.7%. And one of the ways you can see that this recession is milder even than what we had in November is that we had an annual decline in real GDP expected for this year in the November outlook. In this outlook, we have growth in annual GDP of 0.7%. And saying that the recession is mild by historical standards means that the peak-to-trough decline in GDP is lower than you would normally see in a U.S. recession. So the peak-to-trough decline in real GDP is 0.4% for this two-quarter contraction, and the average pre-Great Recession in decline in GDP was 1.7%. And the recovery is forecast to begin in the third quarter of this year. Let's see. Oops. So the next chart shows the forecast path for inflation. The height of the bars shows annual change in the consumer price index, which is one measure of inflation. So we had higher prices last year, including for food and for rent, and those drove inflation to what's now estimated to be 8% in 22. IHS expects slowing demand. So consistent with that recession, they put a recession in the forecast, so they expect demand to slow. That's going to go on along with continuing supply chain normalization. A lot of supply chains are already back to normal, but that's going to continue. And the eventual softening of labor market conditions, so consistent with that upward pressure on the unemployment rate, those things together will slow inflation. They forecast CPI inflation to fall to 4% this year and 2.3% in 24. Both of those are lower values than what we had in November. CPI inflation is expected to average 2.2% per year in 25 through 27. So basically, they expect inflation to slow and get down to within the Fed's target range because the Fed has been acting to slow the economy, and they expect this, you know, upward pressure on the unemployment rate, the recession, the mild recession, those things to slow demand and bring price inflation to be slower. In response to last year's higher inflation, speaking of the Fed began an aggressive monetary policy tightening cycle last spring. They ultimately raised their policy rate 7 times last year and one more time in January. So IHS is expecting 2 more quarter point rate hikes to bring the policy rate to just above 5%. That's a little higher than what we had in November. And that peak happens in this spring. And then they expect the Fed to reverse course in spring of 24 and bring the rate below 3% in 25. This is consistent with the expectation that inflation will settle after 24. So this lower inflation is consistent with that monetary policy story. Sorry. Every mouse on multiple screens here. This chart shows the nominal dollar value of U.S. corporate profits. So it's not a growth rate chart like the other charts that I've shown you. It's dollar values. And we're showing you a long history here, which we don't always do, but we've gone back to 2002 in order to illustrate the extraordinary growth in corporate profits that have occurred since 2020. So from 2011 to 2019, before tax, corporate profits grew 2.8% on average per year. But if you look at 2020 on the graph and look at the sharp jumps up we see there, over 2020 through 22, corporate profits grew 14.5% on average per year. And these gains in U.S. corporate profits drove strong growth in Minnesota's corporate tax receipts in the last 3 fiscal years. And note that the forecast is the years that have an F on them, the 22 and beyond. Notice that the forecast shows moderation in corporate profits. So there's a dip. It actually comes down. And that's this recession that IHS has put in their forecast. And then we have moderate growth after that. So what they're expecting is that this forecast recession is going to usher in a period of weak profits growth, averaging 2.2% in years 23 through 27. And you'll see the effect of both of those, the run up to 22 and then the moderation after that in our corporate profits tax forecast. The right-hand side of the graph shows the change in that profits forecast. The solid line shows the current forecast, and the dashed line shows what we expected in November. And it illustrates that we have a slightly higher forecast for corporate profits in the years of our planning horizon, and that also influences our revenue forecast. Moving to Minnesota's labor market, this chart, which is familiar to all of you, shows the official unemployment rates for Minnesota and the U.S. Minnesota is the dark line. U.S. is always above us. Minnesota's unemployment rate has been increasing since reaching a record low in late July last July of 1.8%. That's a record. It was a record for any state. You will recall that. Despite this recent upward trend, Minnesota still has one of the tightest labor markets in the country with an unemployment rate of 2.5%. It's the lowest, fourth lowest among U.S. states, and it's a percentage point below the U.S. rate. But that gap between Minnesota and the U.S. has been closing. At 67.9%, Minnesota's labor force participation rate remains high relative to the U.S. It's 5.6 percentage points above the U.S. rate and the sixth highest among U.S. states. You also know that there is strong demand for workers across the state. And you know, based on the most recent data we have, there are 4 unemployed job seekers for every 10 job openings. So there remains little slack in the labor market, Minnesota's labor market, compared to other states. Related to the labor market, of course, this chart shows annual change in Minnesota employment. So this is the change in the number of people working in the state. The dark bars show the history in our current forecast, and light bars show what we expected in November. And this, the forecast here is our forecast, MMB's forecast. After declining 6.6% during the pandemic recession of 2020, Minnesota employment grew 2.4% and 2.8% in 21 and 22, respectively. With the stronger February U.S. outlook, we have raised our forecast for Minnesota employment growth to 0.7% this year and 0.5% next year from our prior forecasts of 0.3 and 0. At the left-hand side of the chart, you can see employment growth prior to the recession of 2020. So we don't show you the full history, but let me tell you about the longer history here. From 2011 to 2019, Minnesota employers added an average of 38,000 jobs or 1.4% growth per year. But in 18 and 19, employment growth had slowed to less than 1%, around 22,000 jobs per year. As now this was occurring, we've talked about this before, prior to the pandemic recession, as tight labor supply was limiting Minnesota employers' ability to add jobs. As labor supply limitations continue, we expect further slowing to 12,000 jobs annually in 23 through 27. I'm turning now to the revenue forecast. The first two columns show our current forecast for the current biennium and the forecast change since November. And the second two columns show the same thing for the next biennium. So you heard from the commissioner, and I'm sure you all follow our monthly revenue report. So you know that since November, general fund receipts have exceeded our forecast. So those higher receipts so far in fiscal year 23, that's $487 million higher than what we forecast in November, those raise the revenue forecast for the current biennium. So that's basically the story in the current biennium. Total revenues for the current biennium are now forecast to be $753 million more than in the November forecast. So specifically, we've raised the forecasts for the individual and corporate taxes. Those are the taxes for which receipts since the last recession have come in ahead of since the last forecast have come in ahead of forecast so far this fiscal year. And then we reduced the forecast for sales and other taxes. And those are the taxes where receipts have fallen short of what we expected in November. Now moving to the next biennium, total revenues for the next biennium are now forecast to be $599 million more than the November forecast. You saw that $599 million in the commissioner's table of numbers and on that bar chart. Higher forecasts for individual and corporate tax revenue offset lower forecasts for sales and other revenues. So the pattern's the same in the next biennium as it was in the last. Individual income tax receipts are now expected to be $563 million more than we projected in November. This change is primarily due to higher observed and expected tax payments from non-corporate businesses, specifically partnerships and S corporations. The sales tax is now forecast to generate $26 million less than the prior estimate. This is due to that lower base from the reduced current biennium forecast and slower growth in taxable sales in fiscal years 24 and 25. Slower forecast growth. For the corporate tax, a higher base from the increased current biennium forecast and the higher expected growth in corporate profits that I illustrated earlier raise our revenue projection by $125 million over the prior estimate. So the story I'm going to tell you now is the same, is similar to what I told you in November. We've raised our corporate tax forecast or corporate franchise tax revenue forecast, but the new forecast actually represents a decline in expected corporate receipts from the current biennium to the next. So if you look at the corporate franchise tax line in the table, in the current biennium, we're expecting $5.6 billion of corporate franchise tax receipts. In the next biennium, we're expecting $4.6 billion. So that occurs as the recession creates a drag on the corporate sector. And recall on that corporate profits, U.S. corporate profits chart, corporate profits actually declined due to this recession. I'm going to finish by reiterating some of the risks to the forecast. Since November, price indices have generally come in lower than IHS expected, so that's good news. Nevertheless, persistent inflation could lead the Fed to act more aggressively to raise interest rates than IHS assumes in their baseline outlook. So inflation remains a risk factor if it persists. A lot of U.S. economic data have been coming in stronger than expected, coming in, quote unquote, hot. And so if inflation persists, the Fed may act more aggressively, keep interest rates higher, and that will slow growth below what we have here in this outlook. Moreover, monetary policy, as you've heard me say, works with long and difficult to predict lags. So even if monetary policy follows the path that IHS expects, the result could be different. We could have, more job losses and lower GDP growth than IHS expects. The corporate sector and financial markets are dynamic and have behaved in unpredictable ways in recent years through the recession and beyond, through the pandemic recession and beyond. For example, that unusually fast growth in corporate profits I showed you earlier. It's difficult to estimate how much this aggressive monetary policy that we're experiencing now and the recession that is expected will affect volatile income sources such as corporate profits and capital gains realizations. And as I mentioned on forecast release day on Monday, the U.S. government has exceeded the debt limit. The Treasury is engaging in those so-called extraordinary measures, and those are going to run out in June. This outlook, IHS's outlook, assumes that the debt ceiling will be lifted in time for the Treasury to make timely payments on its obligations. But if that doesn't happen, the negative economic effects will quickly mount, and that could risk triggering a deep recession. And then with the long amount of time left before the end of 2024-25, it's very hard to know what's going to happen in those 28 months. And we could have, even if we have small changes, and we could have large changes, but even if we have small changes in assumed growth rates and some of the volatile factors like corporate profits and capital gains, we could end up with changes in the budget outlook. I will now pass it on to State Budget Director Anna Mingi.
Director Mingi, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, members. I'm Anna Mingi, State Budget Director with Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm going to walk through changes in the state's spending forecast and then turn it back to the commissioner, who will give an overview of our long-term budget outlook. So we can go to the next slide, where you see a table showing changes in our forecast spending in both the current biennium, 22-23, and the next biennium, the budget years, 2024 and 2025. As the commissioner alluded, there are some big changes in the spending forecast. But first, I'm going to walk through the sort of changes in the 22-23 biennium before going on to the budget years. So you can see on this table, it breaks out spending changes by a major spending area. And looking at the first line, E-12 education, that's our largest area of state spending. And our forecast here is that slightly lower spending, about $40 million in lower spending in the 22-23 biennium. This is due to lower than previously estimated pupils for due to actual pupil counts in 2022 coming in sort of at the end of last year and bringing down our forecasts. And that also reduces projected pupils in 2023. On the next line, health and human services spending is also projected to be slightly lower than our November estimates, about $26 million in this case. This includes approximately $103 million in savings to the state due to changes in the federal law related to the COVID-19 public health emergency and requirements for states to maintain continuous Medicaid coverage. The federal enhanced match and Medicaid continuous coverage have been recurring stories in budget forecasts over the last several years. But for the last 3 years, states have received an additional 6.2 percentage points on their federal share of Medicaid as long as they maintain continuous coverage for enrollees and a federal public health emergency related to COVID was in place. However, with the enactment of the Consolidated Appropriations Act, the federal budget bill that passed late last year, enhanced federal match is no longer tied to the existence of a federal public health emergency. Instead, through this federal legislative action, states must now begin to unwind the continuous Medicaid coverage starting in April of 2023 and complete this process within 14 months. But to financially support states through this transition, the federal government will provide additional federal match with steps down each calendar quarter through the end of 2023. So for the quarter April through June of 2023, it's a 5% match, stepping down to 2.5% in the next quarter, and finally 1.5% in the last quarter of this calendar year. And it's this match that produces most of the savings in the health and human services area in this biennium. But those savings are partially offset by higher enrollment that we're seeing in medical assistance. So you can see that moving on, property tax aids and credits and debt service are relatively unchanged from our November forecast, and all other areas of the state budget are a combined $39 million below previous estimates. So that leads to a total reduction in state spending of $112 million in the current biennium relative to our November forecast. So let's move to the next biennium, 2024 and 2025. We can see projected spending in the general fund is forecast to reach over $55 billion in the next biennium, which is an increase of $1.5 billion from November. But almost all of this change is a result of recent legislation requiring MMB to forecast an estimate of the impact of inflation on state spending. You can see that this inflation estimate is tracked as a separate line on the table rather than allocated across bill areas. So starting at the top, education spending is about $50 million above previous estimates, due largely to higher spending on special education transportation, which is a cost-driven program, and we've seen actual costs come in above our previous estimates. In health and human services, total spending is only $3 million above prior estimates. This is a very small change in the health and human services area, but the small number obscures some significant moving pieces. So the higher enrollment that I mentioned in the current biennium continues into the next biennium, which is increasing our costs in medical assistance. But there are ongoing additional state savings in fiscal year 2024 related to that enhanced FMAP coming from the Consolidated Appropriations Act, which offsets some of those higher costs. So moving on, property tax aids and credits is forecast to be about $38 million lower than previous forecasts, due primarily to lower projected spending on the homestead credit refund. And spending on debt service is relatively unchanged from previous projections, just down slightly due to lower projected interest rates. And then in the second to last line, in all other areas of this general fund spending, it was projected to be $105 million higher than previous estimates. The largest driver of this change is this cost increase is that the forecast now reflects costs associated with the renovation of the state office building. The forecast includes both debt service costs as well as general fund costs related to design, tenant relocation, and other non-bondable costs. So the last sort of line in this breakout is the estimate of inflation, which we currently project to be $1.4 billion in the 24-25 biennium. And this is calculated by applying future growth in the consumer price index against portions of the general fund budget that don't already include inflationary growth or where inflation is not appropriate to apply. It doesn't account for inflation that occurred in the past on already appropriated items. So let's move to the next slide and look a little more at the inflation change. So this chart shows both our base spending as well as the incremental impact of adding inflation to the state spending forecast across the forecast horizon. By adding inflation to the forecast, we are increasing our forecast of state spending by $1.4 billion in the 24-25 biennium and about $3 billion in the 26-27 biennium. As you can see, even without this new inflationary estimate, state programs were projected to grow year over year, but only at a rate of about 1.5% in 26 and 2027. This is partially due to the fact that some of our base spending already includes inflationary growth to account for higher costs. Programs like our nursing facility, value-based reimbursement program, and our special education formula. But by now including estimates of inflation for the remainder of state general fund spending, the forecast better reflects the pressure that state agency budgets face to maintain current levels of state government service. So I'll turn it back to Commissioner Showalter to move up the long-term outlook.
Thank you. The last slide on this presentation is something that's going to be really familiar to y'all. It is the long-term budget outlook looking at forecast revenues and forecast spending, lining up just what's happening in each of those biennium, takes out the picture of those carry-forward dollars that I started with the introduction, and just looks at what's happening in each biennium. You'll see that the forecast revenues on the left-hand side for 24 and 25 are about $60.8 billion. The current law spending number is $55.5 billion, leaving a structural balance of about 5.3. That structural balance is pretty much mirrored in the 26-27 numbers, where you continue to see revenues under current law outpacing projected spending for that biennium, leaving a structural balance of about $5.4 billion. Essentially, what that says is the revenues and spending are growing at roughly the same rate as you see on the right-hand side. The key difference, obviously, in this chart is something that we've always pointed out, is that the spending numbers have an impact of inflation. This time, that inflation is folded into the expenditure number and netted out of that structural balance. So the amount of the inflation included in those estimates above are shown there on brackets at the bottom of the page. Looking at, does this mean that our structural balance is worse than it was before? It really, what it's done, we're counting it differently. That the structural balance that we had anticipated in the last forecast was $6.3 billion in 24 and 25. But underneath the line, we had a estimated inflation of $1.5 billion, leaving a November structural balance of 4.8 for that first biennium. For the tails, we had estimated an $8.4 billion structural balance, but there was inflation underneath the line of $3.3 billion, leaving 5.1. So you look at what we've got here, actually the structural balance is very similar, if not just slightly better, than it was in previous forecast. And it's all really about, as Director Mingy mentioned, how we're preparing the forecast and treating inflation in these numbers. So that really wraps up the formal remarks of this presentation. You know, we started the presentation with an image of some cross-country skiers going over a long, flat place. Partly we're just drawn to the amount of snow that was there. Today it feels particularly prescient. But the fact of the matter is, you know, there's a long view here, and it's unclear what's the path going forward. But, you know, we're certainly in a stable place. The economy is continuing to perform in ways that we would expect and hope. That bottom line is our budget is in a very strong position. This is bolstered by a very large carry-forward amount that really boosts the amount of resources that are available this year. And right now we've got a rough match between revenues and spending. So it's a great position for the state to be in. It's a great start for really preparing this budget and preparing a lot of public policy for the rest of the session. And with that, chairs, that concludes our remarks and presentation for today.
Thank you, Commissioner. And with that, we'll turn to member discussion. So are there any members seeking recognition? We'll give it a second to see the Zoom participants pop up as well. I do. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I'd like to go back to page 14. And if I understand it right, the total spending from $51 billion to $55 billion is about an 8% growth over the two bienniums. And I understand that actually includes inflationary cost. even if we subtract the inflationary cost, I think it still runs about 5% growth in actual state spending, which, according to your inflation charts earlier in this presentation, was about inflation. So, first of all, am I correct in reading that? And that does not include any future spending that this legislature may do between now and the end of session. Is those two things correct?
Commissioner Showalter.
I'll start, Chair and Representative, and Director McGee can follow up. I think the first thing to note is on Health and Human Services or any of these spending lines, they are, as you say, based on current law. In some of the health care programs, you may have adjustments in rates. For instance, on nursing homes or other services, you have adjustments based upon historic costs. Also, they're a change based upon enrollment. So places where you have changes in enrollment in your health care programs, you'll also see changes between the biennium above and beyond just pure inflation. So just note that the inflation and the estimated inflation is only part of the overall sort of changes between the biennium and the spending growth. So I think I'm trying to get at your question. Like, there is spending growth there, and it is not just the factor of inflation. It is also other factors that are specific to those programs. Is this before any new legislation this year? Absolutely. This is a starting point. Changes in the appropriation bills this session would change these numbers, and we'll work with fiscal staff to estimate those impacts and show you the net.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could just follow up quickly. But in reality, state spending is growing even without adding the inflationary. It's growing at the same rate of inflation as everybody else's paychecks and so forth as well. And I think that's a concern when we start talking about not only adding another 2.5 or 3% additional inflationary on top of the budgets that we're going to be spending additional dollars this year as well. I think that indicates that the state is certainly spending more dollars at a higher rate than what the average public is. And so I think it's a concern for us to be aware of when we start dealing with which future expenditure dollars. Thank you.
Representative Cleavorne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, this is kind of a follow-up on Representative Petersburg's comment about growing state spending. As you may be well aware, I'm very concerned about our growing aging population. And so as we are looking at these budget forecasts going forward, and we're looking at the changing demographics, so we have a lot of young, we have a lot of old, are we going to be doing a comprehensive look into what that is going to do to our state spending further down the road? So looking at decades at a time, not just a few biennia at a time.
Commissioner Showalter.
Chair, a representative, a great question. You know, that kind of long-term planning isn't something that we routinely do at present. As you know, we have some ideas of building that out. There is the State Demographer's Office that does some of that in work, and we will certainly work with them, particularly on some of the underlying economic assumptions. The growth in elderly, disabled populations of the state drive our health care expenditures. And I don't have a particular report to point to, but absolutely that is a concern, and that's a core strategy issue for state budget making.
Representative Cleavorne.
Thank you.
Further discussion from members? Give the Zoom folks a minute. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is I think my first question is for Dr. Kalamakidis. You mentioned expecting a recession in Q1 and Q2. What are we seeing? I know the January GDP number isn't out yet, but when do we expect that, and what are you expecting to see in that January number?
Dr. Kalamakidis.
Chairs, members, Senator Pratt, what am I expecting to see? So IHS puts out, in addition to their monthly forecasts, they put out a GDP tracker, meaning they show how their, as economic data come in, They show how their expectations for the quarterly growth change. And for the first quarter of this year, which they have in this outlook, they have, I think, a decline of 1.3%. Their GDP tracker shows a decline of less than 1%. And so with that, what I'm saying is that the quarterly growth that they're expecting now, or the quarterly decline that they're expecting now, is less than the quarterly decline they were expecting when they released this outlook. So that means their expectations have improved with regard to U.S. real GDP growth.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Kalamakidis, you talked about an investor-driven recession, not driven by consumer spending, but I thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, did you say the housing market was considered part of that non-consumer spending that would be more investor-driven?
Dr. Kalamakidis.
Chairs, Senator, members, yes. So this part of what we mean by investment is business investment, and that includes residential, meaning building houses, and it includes non-residential investment, including, you know, buying equipment and, you know, accumulating inventories.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you. Dr. Kalamakidis, going to slide 8, we talked about the jump in nominal profits, and I'm just going to throw out a couple of questions here, and I'll let you just address them as you feel. So the nominal does not include the impact of inflation, and certainly I think the businesses would have felt inflationary pressures before they reported by the government. So do we have this look on a real growth basis? And then can you talk about the drivers that would have gone into that growth? I'm certainly thinking of, the labor shortage. Certainly we've heard about wage inflation pushing up. Certainly we saw inputs due to the supply chain shortage push prices up, and just an overall disequilibrium between supply and demand. Any other thoughts on that, and maybe your thoughts on the real growth?
Dr. Kalamakidis.
Chairs, members, Senator Pratt. Yeah, it's a good point, but this is nominal. I don't have a chart showing inflation-adjusted corporate profits, real. But we should be able to provide that for you. I'm just trying to think if it's a variable that we get provided by IHS. But what I meant to convey in my comments was that this run-up from 20 through 22 exceeds the rate of inflation in that period. And so that must mean that real corporate profits were growing at that time. And so the percentage increases in corporate profits on average over those years exceeded the percentage increases in the price indices. And what was happening during that time, you're right, just really extraordinary changes in the economy from the beginning of the recession, the pandemic, through last year, including, yes, price pressures, cost pressures for businesses, and inflation occurring as well. So they were pushing some of those costs forward. Generally, through that period, wage increases lagged in price inflation. That's shifting now. We're expecting real increases in wages. But during this period of this run-up, wages were not keeping up with inflation.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I think this will be my last question, at least for a while. Ms. Bingy, I was trying to take a quick note here, and when you were talking about the individual income tax, I thought you made a comment about the sub-S corporations. Could you expand on that?
Director Mingy.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, I think that would have been Dr. Kalamakidis.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was in the revenue forecast. I'm sorry.
Do you have a Senator Pratt? Do you want to ask a question to
sure.
Dr. Kalamakidis?
Yes,
okay, Senator Pratt.
Was that the question?
That was the question. Okay. I was trying to take the note, and we talked about higher taxes from consumer, and I thought she said sub S, and I was just looking at for a little more context around this sub S piece. Mm-hmm. Since it's businesses running their taxes through their personal filings.
Dr. Kalmanketis.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, Senator Pratt. Yeah, that was the part of the forecast change in the individual income tax for the next biennium for fiscal years 22, 24, and 25. We have seen higher than expected tax payments from non-corporate businesses, specifically partnerships and S-corps, and we expect some of those increased payments to continue. We don't expect it to continue at the same rate that we had seen, but that's part of what grew the forecast here is payments, individual income tax liability that arises from business owners getting profits from their partnerships and S-corps.
Senator Pratt.
Well, thank you, Dr. Kalmanketis. So as I'm looking at the decline biennium on the corporate franchise tax, would we expect a nominal decline in the sub-S and non-corporate tax while we might continue to see flat to higher individual tax receipts?
Dr. Kalmanketis.
Madam Chair, members, Senator Pratt, good question. So I think what you're asking is, we've got this decline pattern as the recession hits corporations. Should we expect the same sort of declining pattern as the recession hits those non-corporate businesses? That's what you're asking?
Correct.
Right. That's part of why, even though we've seen larger than expected payments by these non-corporate businesses, we're not expecting all of that. We're not expecting that growth to continue indefinitely. So we have adjusted our forecast for our expectations of what's going on in the economy for these kinds of businesses. But that's a helpful observation.
Thank you.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just kind of on the same topic, as I was looking at slide 8 at the corporate profits forecast, it looks pretty much exactly like the trend is exactly the same as two graphs that we saw in our introduction to taxes. And those would be so this is really important because as we're talking about this surplus, we have to remember where it came from. And so this graph of these really incredible corporate profits, the exploding corporate profits, track pretty much exactly with corporate collections and with individual income tax collections. And to the questions about wage inflation, and my staff did a little bit of analysis for me. From 2019 to 2021, wages went up 7.7%. Capital gains, this is in Minnesota resident returns, capital gains went up 141.7%. Pass-through income, those partnerships and S-corps, their profits went up 37.1%. And so, when we talk about this, we have to understand, right, during the pandemic, when we had CNAs, home health care workers, all of our frontline healthcare workers were putting themselves on the line to try to assist people who were ill. When we had people in our communities dying, you should see, please check out the images from Worthington pork producing plants in 2020 and the conditions that those workers were in. Together, side by side, no PPE at that point, okay? Breathing each other's air. The top 1% during this deadly global pandemic gained $12 trillion in wealth. During the pandemic, while we had unprecedented levels of people visiting food shelves for the first time sometimes. People unable to pay their rent. People literally dying. The wealthiest among us, the largest corporations, extracted trillions of dollars of wealth during that time. And like a lot of us are invested in the stock market, right, through our retirements and stuff, but the top 10% of wealth earners in or the top 10% of income of income earners, or the top 10% like wealthiest Americans, own over 80% of individually held stocks. So that's not what this is. This isn't about like working class and middle class people being invested in the stock market, right? It's what we're seeing. The reason that we have this unprecedented surplus is because of economic inequality in our economy. It's because of how hard it is increasingly for working class and middle class people to make a way for themselves and their families. And so I think this is really, really important information for us to think about, because there's going to be a temptation when we see this eye-popping number to make permanent structural cuts to revenue that disproportionately go to the wealthiest Minnesotans. But guess what? They've gotten theirs. They've been getting theirs for years, and they've really gotten theirs in the last 2 and 3 years while our communities have been suffering. Who didn't get theirs? Healthcare workers. Who didn't get theirs? People who kept our food systems going. Who didn't get theirs? People in the grocery stores working to make sure that those of us who were lucky enough to stay home and work remotely could still have the things that we needed for ourselves and our families. And so this is just really, this is a fairness and equity issue. And so we have to be very clear when we're looking at this budget surplus, whose backs was it earned on? And who made, like, when you collect revenue, it's like a little teeny, teeny percent of the profit that somebody got, of the income that somebody got, right? So we have to resist the urge to say, like, we're going to give this money, we're going to spend this money not on our schools, on our early childhood system that is suffering and needs it, on housing that we know we're in the middle of a housing crisis, on our dire infrastructure needs, that we're going to give it to the wealthiest Minnesotans who have already made a windfall in the last 3 years. We have to be very careful in this moment, even with this sort of eye-popping number in front of us. There's a reason that it happened this way. So it's a bit of a rant, but I also just want to thank, the tax person in me, of course. Thank you for talking about the volatility of capital gains and corporate collections as that sort of final caveat. That's also really important for us to think of in this moment, because those gains that we saw in the last 3 years, because of this sort of distortion in the economy that was an enhancement of the economic inequality that we have seen growing over decades in our country, it's not necessarily going to be there in the future. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Chair Gomez for putting that into perspective, too. Anytime we look at the stability going forward, think about, and this is the education chair and me, thinking about the biggest portion of our budget we spend our money on is the investment in our youngest learners and our K-12 learners who build our workforce. And as we're looking forward to what we want our economy to look like and what we want our state to look like, we know through the state demographer that we have been on a downward slide for demographics with an aging population for decades. We knew it was coming. And now it's time that it's going to hit. It's going to hit our workforce. And we're going to need every single one of our learners to be ready to hit that workforce. And if we don't make those investments now and dig into that, like what we see as a surplus, look at the structural surplus. I can tell you right now, if we index the formula to inflation, put money on the formula, start tackling the SPED cross subsidy and the ELL cross subsidy, that almost takes up the entire stable the entire part of our forecast that is actually a structural surplus. It's gone. And that's just investing in our schools. That doesn't mention having to invest in housing, because you know what? Kids can't learn well when they don't know where they're sleeping at night. That's not making sure that they're fed. That's not making sure that we're all of our learners have everything they need to be part of that workforce that we desperately need. So looking forward, I want us to really think about how we want our future stability and our revenue stream to look, because if we're not careful, we're going to fall off that cliff. And the folks that we depend on the most to put that workforce in place aren't going to be there. And then I did have one question, too, because one of my concerns about that stability going forward and more along the lines of what Chair Gomez was saying about who ends up paying this, a lot of the tax cuts in the ILJ and the tax cuts that were put in place by the previous administration continue on for some of our corporations and businesses, but the individual ones go away in 2026. So we might get to see this tiny little revenue bump, but it's from the same people that have been paying, as Chair Gomez said, have been paying time and time again. So I would like to keep those folks in our thoughts as we move forward with this, because I know you're not forecasting out past 27, but that's one of the other things that keeps me up at night, besides making sure that we educate a future workforce that can take care of Minnesotans. Thanks.
Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair Olson, and great discussion. Just a couple observations, I think, on the capital gains comment. I think part of the increase in capital gains was due to the fact that a lot of businesses were shut down and a lot of people decided to exit their long-term business and move on and sell it to somebody else to start over. So I know personally I received dozens of calls from people that after or post-COVID or during COVID, they decided to sell their assets and would then have some capital gains, and that's probably due to the increase. And then I think on the corporate profits, I think a lot of that profit is from the COVID money that flew through the state, the billions of dollars that we did get here in Minnesota. And I do think a lot of the larger corporations were able to profit from that, and that's part of the reason we saw that higher tax collection and why we're in the surplus is due to all the funds from both the state and the federal government flooding, if you will, our economy, and now we have this inflation. So thank you.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really grateful. I always like getting the forecast, and I like that we talk about both the dollars and the demographic changes that we're experiencing, because they're so hand in hand if we want to think about the work that we need to do for Minnesotans. And as I listened to Representative Gomez talk about sort of the disparity in the income inequality, I am called to mind an issue that I have been doing some work on, though it hasn't been very publicly noticed, which is about the problem that we're having with children being essentially transferred to hospitals, and then they're boarding in our hospitals, in part because either the foster caregivers, the group homes, et cetera, no longer have adequate staffing to adequately care for those kids. And so in hospitals in Minnesota, we have minors, we have young kids that are spending an inordinate amount of time in our hospitals because there's no place for them to go, which is a reflection from my perspective of the price we are paying, because people who work in home care, in nursing homes, in parts of our hospitals, in group homes, in child care, those jobs that are intended to care for our loved ones are so underpaid, and people have left them. And we are seeing a worker crisis and a caregiving crisis in facilities across the state of Minnesota. And it's impacting all of us, our families, and our loved ones. And we have made an intentional choice, whether we say it out loud or not, to pay those workers a very low wage. Child care is a low-wage job. Nursing homes, a low-wage job. group homes a low-wage job, and we have a persistent turnover. We know about this. And we're seeing it pronounced in this document in a way that is really stunning. And if our job is to make sure that Minnesotans are getting the care that they need when they need it, or we're investing in the people who do the work so that our young learners are prepared to enter into school, our young learners come through our K-12 system with ESPs, with paras who are there to prepare them. And if we want our loved ones who may have physical or intellectual disability, who are aging and can't live at home anymore, if we want them to live the lives that we wish for them, then we have to pay attention to our workforce, and it is in tatters, in part because of the pandemic, but because of choices that we've made in the budget over many, many years. And as I look at this document, that really stands out for me. And it is mission critical from my perspective for this legislature. And so I wanted to just thank Representative Gomez for drawing that finer point about who is benefiting and who's paying the price in this current economy, and then to draw our attention to our mutual goal of making sure that we have people in place to care for the people who we love. Thank you.
Senator Frentz.
Well, first of all, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Director. Thank you, Dr. Kolomakidis. You know, the information in front of us allows us to make the choices we got to make. We got a lot of voices at the table. I'm excited to have our brothers and sisters from the House over here. And I would say some of the basics of these reports are, I think, the most valuable. And I tend to be an optimist. And I look at the report and I see labor participation rate amongst the tops in the country. We got great schools. Representative Joachim, and we'll be there at budget time to talk about how we fund and prepare the next generation. And looking particularly at the unemployment rate. So as we talk about workforce and where they're going and our priorities, Mankato reported in November 1.8% unemployment, the lowest of any city in the country at the time. We have people working, we have a labor participation rate, and we're short of workers. And I hope one of our discussions is how we bring people to Minnesota to fulfill these jobs, not just in long-term care, not just in education, but across these sectors. I did have one question for Dr. Kolomakidis, I think, if that's okay, Madam Chair. You know, we're projecting, speaking of the corporate franchise tax, in 2024-25, what looks like about a 19% drop in the corporate franchise tax revenue, and yet I thought we were talking about a relatively mild two-quarter recession. So are we talking about a fairly serious drag in our predictions? I think this is for Dr. Kolomakidis. If we're having recession and it's mild, less than 1% for two quarters, but we're showing a drop that is disproportionate, our individual income tax forecast doesn't show any such drop. Is there something about the recession which is going to affect corporate franchise revenue that isn't affecting individual income tax revenue? Or is that recession deeper than we're giving it credit for? Or did I miss a meeting?
Dr. Kolomakidis.
Madam Chair, members, really, really good question. I guess the way I would answer that, so our forecast for Minnesota's corporate tax revenue is driven by a number of different variables, one of which, the most important one of which, is the forecast for U.S. corporate profits, because we tax multi-jurisdiction corporations here in Minnesota. And so I went back to that chart, that look at the far right-hand side of the chart, and you can see the actual decline in corporate profits that are forecast in 23. It looks like 23, and then it comes back to moderate growth. So the part of this is the unusual run up to 22 of corporate profits. So that's coming to an end here with this recession. And then the recession, the way IHS describes it, and this makes sense to me, is that the recession is ushering in a period of weak corporate profits. We've had a period of strong corporate profits, and now we're getting into a period of weaker corporate profits. And so is this mild recession affecting the corporate sector differently than, say, households? Maybe, yes, because the corporate sector got this big run-up prior to where we are now. more so than households did. And so the slowdown is hitting them, is bringing in this weaker period. Another thing to think about is that the corporate franchise tax is our most volatile revenue source. Second is the individual income tax. And within the individual income tax, the most volatile income source is capital gains. And so corporate profits themselves are highly volatile. Capital gains are highly volatile. So seeing changes, and wages are relatively stable, not completely stable, but they grow more predictably. And so seeing changes in the corporate profits forecast and changes in the corporate franchise tax forecast is not unusual because of that volatility. Thanks for the question.
Senator Frantz.
Thank you very much, Doctor, especially pointing to the run-up. That helps put some context on it. Thank you again for the report, and thank you, Madam Chair.
And we have one more member on the list seeking recognition, and then we do have to adjourn by 10 for House members to get to session. So we'll go to the last member on the list. I'll say something, then I'll turn it over to Senator Marty to close us out. I think we'll just stick with what we have on the list, Senator Pratt. I apologize, we do have to get to session. So I will go to Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the presenters. I think this is a question for Dr. Columbakidis. You mentioned impacts of the housing market. I'm just wondering if you could expand a little bit about what this forecast, in particular rising interest rates, is telling us about the housing market going forward.
Dr. Columbakidis.
Yes, chairs, members. So this slowdown or recession, the two quarters of contraction that IHS is expecting, is being driven by interest rate sensitive sectors. So those sectors where when interest rates go up, activity goes down. And so while mortgage interest rates have come down recently, they did run up last year, and that increase in mortgage interest rates slowed home sales and home purchases. Less so in Minnesota than in lots of other places, though. So we've had relative stability. So what does that mean for investment in housing? If you look at home construction, we have enough building in the pipeline that construction is still ongoing, and construction workers are still being employed. In fact, I'm sure people in construction are still looking for workers. But when that pipeline plays out, if interest rates stay higher for longer, then that's going to slow the housing sector further.
Representative Howard.
Thank you. I think that's really important for us. I'm just struck by, again, we're in this time of historic surplus, while over the last year we're facing a deepening and worsening housing crisis. Family homelessness was up 200% or more last year. We had 20,000 evictions in Minnesota, and this report is telling us there's risk that we have pressures that are going to make it harder to build the homes that we need. We already have a more than 100,000 unit gap in terms of homes that are deeply affordable. Already we have a market that is not responding to the needs of our community, and those pressures are only growing. And I just think that should be ever present on our minds when we consider what we do and how we move forward with this budget surplus this session. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to just, as we come to a conclusion here, say thank you to the Commissioner, thank you to Budget Director Mingy, and thank you to Dr. Columbakidis for being here and for giving us such a thorough walkthrough. And it really is clear we have our work cut out for us, even with a surplus, to have a deep dive understanding of how we got here and how we make sure Minnesota continues to be a well-run state that funds the things we care about. And it's despite having money, as we heard from the comments here, it doesn't make our jobs necessarily easier. We still have really hard decisions we'll need to be making, and look forward to working with the chairs around this table and with the members around this table on both sides of the aisle to do that. And I know we didn't get to everybody's question to come back for another bite at the apple, Senator Pratt, but I'm sure that the commissioner will be happy to have that conversation too, as the rest of us have to scoot out and get to session. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Senator Marty to close us out for the meeting today.
Thank you, and thanks for the House for coming over here. Maybe next time we'll head over your way. But thanks for presentations as well. And again, as we know, this is just the forecast. This is not what we are working the next couple months is. But we have a lot of difficulties ahead, and I just wanted to throw in for one food for thought for members of the committees in both houses, and that is that the inflation bill that passed for the forecast doesn't change any of our budget, but it just changes the forecast. That factors in from inflation now what it would take to fund all those things over the next 2 years. If we go back 2 years to the budget that was cut, a bipartisan budget between House Democrats and Senate Republicans and signed by the governor, what would it take to keep up with that budget if we want to keep the same level of services and everything else in schools and housing, everything else? And I had asked MMB and Senate fiscal folks to come up with a number, the unrecognized inflation from what actually happened based on what we had. And while we have a structural balance of $5.3 billion, the numbers based on new forecasts would have been to go back 2 years, keep the same level of funding, would take $4.9 billion away. So in other words, when we talk surplus, we got to remember that it's surplus because we haven't factored that in the past. And I just think that's food for thought. I'm happy to share the spreadsheets that they provided on that. But that doesn't change how we budget. It just tells us where we are. It's the roadmap for what we're working from. And with that, I think we're going to have lots of discussion in Senate Finance and House Ways and Means. Wish you well. Thank you all for the thing. And this meeting's adjourned.